This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Freddie Gray. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing the horrific events in Las Vegas on Sunday night and asking if there's any appropriate response at all that the media should have. We'll also be looking at the contentious Catalan referendum and wondering what makes the perfect pub quiz. First up, atrocity in America. Sunday night's horrific slaughter in Las Vegas has led to the inevitable agonised debate about gun control. But should we, the media, be hastily asking such questions? Or is it better in the face of such horror just to stay quiet? I'm joined by Lionel Shriver, our new columnist and author famously of a novel We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was about a school massacre, and another of our columnists, Rod Little. Lionel, in your piece this week, you suggest that perhaps Brits might learn to pipe down a little bit when talking to Americans about gun rights. Is this something that British people just do whenever there's a shooting, a massacre in America?
Oh, it's become a ritual, and it's tiresome. It's not that there's not truth to it. Yes, the U.S. has lax gun laws, some states more than others, and one of the laxest is indeed Nevada, though we don't know where all those guns were sourced from this time. It's just, it doesn't do any good. Americans are not interested in what Brits think of their gun laws. They're not going to change their gun laws because they're not popular in London. And this is just an exercise in British superiority. You know, here, you know, the Brits are civilized. They have restrictions on these dangerous implements, and the Americans are barbarians.
Well, don't you think that's actually the case that we want you to be as pro-gun as possible so we can feel very superior morally?
Oh, yes, it would be terribly disappointing if we actually changed the laws.
And particularly if President Trump did.
Oh, yes, that would be the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, Rod's piece this week is all about the fact that people tend to jump on these incidents to find details in them, true or not, that back up their political prejudices. And this is the same thing. You know, it's usually on a broadcaster level, but it's Jon Snow et al. Nothing against Jon Snow. I like Jon Snow. But, you know, he loves this topic. They all love this topic. It's repetitive. It's a single view of a complex problem, which is not only an American problem, but is a human problem of the incidence of inexplicable malice in our species. The truth is that even if you introduced very restrictive gun laws, it would still be possible to kill people. I mean, ask the Rwandans. You don't need anything more than a machete. And you're not going to be able to completely restrict all the implements that can be used for ill. And the most profound problem is human nature and the odd and often dreadful things that they are driven to do. And that's the level on which these incidents interest me.
Rod, turning to you, to what extent do you think we, the media, and then this is obviously exacerbated by social media, are to blame for this phenomenon of just hyping up these disasters and horrors?
I think Lionel's absolutely right. I mean, the phrase she didn't use, but which I think it is, certainly on the case of the BBC, and you could see them puffed up with the pleasure of this, is virtue signalling. It's another case of lefty virtue signalling, that here's something that they can get a grip on, and which seems to them, in their narrow, rather stunted world view, to be an absurdity that people should be allowed to have weapons, and that's the thing they go on. And there was a certain glee with which they tore into the US this time, as they did last time. Even in Florida, they were talking about, when the issue really was more about the caliphate and the somewhat hardline views about homosexuality, which exist within some Muslim communities, it was still about gun laws. It's one of those easy subjects which they can get hold of and run with without feeling opprobrium that they're picking on someone who is a victim, a minority race, or anything like that. Instead, they're picking on the President of the United States and the majority of people who live in the country.
And it's implying that there is a simple and obvious solution that if you simply instituted it, would ensure that these incidents and nothing like them would ever happen again. Americans are idiots because, you know, the Brits can see this clear as a bell from across the Atlantic, and the Americans are too thick to get it.
And there's deeper questions, too, because, I mean, guns have been legal in America for a long time, and admittedly, you know, high-velocity automated assault weapons, maybe not. But you could certainly buy a machine gun quite a long time ago in America, and yet these incidents are increasing. there's perhaps deeper questions that we need to ask than, you know, how easy it is to get a gun.
Yes, and I would say that they're increasing because they're increasing, if that doesn't sound too circular.
And that's where the media comes in.
It seems a diminishing word to call things like this a fad, but they are. Mm-hmm. They're a fad. And people are incredibly unimaginative, and they get ideas about how to give meaning to their life from other people. And this is one way to go out with a splash. Most of the adults who go on rampages expect to either kill themselves or be killed. So this is the kind of cherry on a melting sundae. It's a flashy fuck you sayonara.
It is fascinating, Lionel, that actually gun ownership is now increasing, and it's becoming less of a sort of preserve of the right. I noticed that recently that Black Lives Matter, members of Black Lives Matter, were arguing that black people should be armed so that they can protect themselves against the police. I thought that one of the big problems with Black Lives Matter was that quite a lot of black people already are armed, and that this has caused quite a few problems with the police. But actually, the trend, which we always pretend that this is trend towards liberality, towards, well, I don't, but a lot of people do, towards a sort of liberal consensus, and that eventually one would come down on the side of no guns and restrictions on gun ownership. Whereas actually in America, the precise opposite is happening, and the left is taking up the guns as well.
Well, the truth is that given the amount of power that a gun confers on an individual, it is astonishing that everyone doesn't want one.
Yes.
In your piece, you say that the correct reaction, you're in the right mental state if you're dumbstruck by incidents such as these. But as they become more frequent, it's harder to be dumbstruck, isn't it?
You need to preserve your ability to be shocked. And to lose your horror is to not get it, and is to lose a certain humanity. I'm arguing for less is more, is that I grow weary of our straining to derive lessons from these things, to turn them into positive teaching moments so that we get it and we know how to prevent them now and, you know, we're wiser. I don't think we're wiser. I don't think these things teach us anything aside from something about a particular individual's despair. And I think to try to give them meaning is to give them too much credit.
Yes. But do you think if we become weary of them, they lose the sort of oxygen that makes this fad carry on?
Well, you know, I've said for some time now that I think one of the mistakes we make in relation to mass shootings is to make too much of them and to give them too much publicity and be too curious about the background of the shooter and, you know, what kind of family he had and what his hobbies were, gun collecting. The trouble with this advice, and this is something that I address in the piece in The Spectator this week, is that it's impossible to follow. Actually, it reminds me of Margaret Thatcher's effort to starve Sinn Féin of the oxygen of publicity. I mean, how well did that work? And you can't stop people from being curious, and you can't stop journalists from trying to satisfy that curiosity. I enjoy the same curiosity, and I can't help it. I've read about this character, Stephen Paddock, and it wasn't just for work. I wanted to know what made him tick and what was wrong with him and what his beef was, and we still haven't found out, which makes him, if anything, more fascinating.
Yes. Rod, since we all have morbid fascinations with killers and things, would you say the incentive, the need then is to not virtue signal and to admit that we're all slightly titillated by what you might call
I'm
evil?
I'm sure we are and always have been. I don't think you can restrain the press from writing about it, although a certain restraint has been self-imposed by the press. You know, I've written about this for The Spectator several times before, that not with the lone mass killings almost always perpetrated by white guys from the suburbs in America, insofar as one can ever sort of find a common strand, usually lower middle class, this guy a bit better off, but there is without question a restraint now in reporting Muslim atrocities, particularly in Europe. Marseille, the cutting of throats of two poor women, didn't get very much press at all. The attacks in Canada got none whatsoever. And these attacks, because they come day after day after day, the most they get, Marseille got 15 seconds around about fifth story on the BBC News as a sort of, oh, and guess what? They were up to it again in Marseille. You know, and that's, so in a sense, you know, we are playing these things down. We don't do it in America, largely because I think, because it doesn't affect us so much, it doesn't cause within our country a sort of anger and a fury at any particular political disposition. It's something which is isolated and which we can look at from, as Lionel rightly points out, a degree of fascination and as why do these guys do this? And there is the easy answer, which is they're American and they have guns, which is the one which the BBC clings to whenever it reports a story. But I think that fascination will always be there, just as we have a fascination about Fred West, Fred and Rosemary West, you know, and Dennis Nielsen.
Lionel, in your piece, you say that, you know, whenever there's one of these atrocities, you're overwhelmed with people from Sky News or the BBC trying to get you on because you're someone who's written a very famous novel about a high school massacre. Is there a sort of sense that people are sort of turning to you as though you might have an answer because they want fiction to come up with an answer to these atrocities that they associate with fiction?
Well, they come to me because they think that I'm going to have something to say.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily, any more than anyone else. And I do find it ironic that I'm considered an expert on mass killings when all I did is make one up.
Yeah.
So I'm a little worried that if this is the level of expertise that we consider acceptable on modern media, I think they go to me because they think as a fiction writer, I'm going to have a different perspective. The only thing that anyone can seems to be able to come up with is the gun angle. And yeah, they must yeah. secretly know that it's boring, if nothing else. I mean, not just useless, but tedious, even for their own listeners, because we go through this every time. And so, in spite of the fact that they've come to me several times before, I think in the back of their minds, they think that I'm going to come up with a novel interpretation, and so to speak. I fail to give satisfaction most of the time. Not only do I turn most of these offers down because I am anxious about becoming something of a shtick, and I do get tired of saying the same thing over and over again, but because I don't think there's that much to say, and fabricating these false morality tales doesn't help, is a waste of time, and imputes more content to these incidents than I think that they exhibit. It's giving them, as I said, too much credit. And I would rather we curtail our impulse to find meaning in them. I think we need to be able to resign ourselves that this shooting in Las Vegas was utterly pointless. Let's face it, that's what makes it so compelling, because there was no reason to do it. It accomplishes nothing.
Yeah.
I gather it's not being classified as domestic terrorism, and I think that's wise, because there is no apparent agenda here, aside from a kind of negative self-aggrandizement. I think we should leave it at that.
That was Lionel Shriver and Rod Little.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, with Catalonia's long-disputed independence question heading for its most contentious moment, Daniel Hannan writes this week about how Madrid's suppression of the Catalans will only push them further towards independence. He joins me now from Strasbourg. Dan, in your excellent piece this week, you say that violence will only push the Catalans further towards independence, and in fact, the Spanish government has probably done more to advance the cause of Catalan separatism than any Barcelona politician could have dreamed of doing. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, the heat had been going out of the issue since the end of the dictatorship. Catalonia had large-scale autonomy. It had most of the things that self-determination is about. Control of education, control of healthcare, control of local policing. It had its president and its parliament and its flag. So there were always a handful of people who wanted to go the whole hog and have their own embassies and armed forces and a seat at the UN. But it was not a pressing issue for most people until last Sunday. And I think this sense that they're exposed to the possibility of state violence is going to change the calculus for almost all people who were previously neutral or indifferent about it.
But how should a government react to a referendum that in their eyes is completely illegal and in fact was illegal?
By refusing to recognise the outcome. I mean, I genuinely couldn't believe the way I saw this thing unfolding. Most of my friends in Spain are conservatives and are unionists, including most of my Catalan friends. And I had this conversation over and over with them where I would say, do you realise the impact this is going to have? Imagine if we had done this in Scotland and so on. And there was just no meeting of minds. They would look at me blankly and say, but that's the law of the Constitution and so on. And I would say, well, that may, in a very legalistic sense, be true, but actually preventing a vote taking place is going to create the thing you say you're against. And I don't know, I think there's just, it's one of those areas where there is just a difference in approach. There is a streak of authoritarianism in a bit of the Spanish right, which has genuine popular support. And it's the fundamental cultural difference, I think, that makes the Scottish experience so different from the Catalan one.
Yes, and in fact, that Spanish authoritarianism has a strong anti-intellectual strain, as you say in your piece.
Well, you know, it's the oddest thing. I could understand a nationalist feeling that Catalonia was nothing to do with him, seeing it as an alien thing and wanting to get rid of it. Or I could understand someone saying, this is part of our country, we love it very dearly, these people are our fellow citizens and we should make sure that they feel that they have co-ownership of the state. What you can't do is, on the one hand, treat people with disdain, almost with contempt, and on the other hand, refuse to let them go, because that isn't the way you treat fellow citizens. That's the way you treat conquered vassals. And how do you expect them to respond? How would Scots have responded if the Met had been deployed to prevent the vote, if a number of SNP politicians had been prosecuted, if officials had been taken into custody simply for carrying out the instructions at polling stations, if London Tory politicians had been saying, we need to make the Scots more English? I mean, I think everyone listening knows how people would have reacted. Scotland would have concluded that they no longer had a stake in the running of the country as co-owners, and they would quite rightly have walked out. And it just seemed to me so obvious that this was going to happen if Madrid went down the road it did. And yet, I have to say, you know, you find almost no Spanish rightist. In fact, you find remarkably few people in Castilian-speaking Spain generally who are not supporting the government's action.
To what extent was it actually a brutal crackdown, and to what extent was it actually bad PR? Because I think the reports vary from almost 1,000 people were in hospital to just 2. And obviously the pictures were quite shocking. But do you think this sort of clampdown has been blown out of proportion in the media?
I have no idea. But the whole approach of the Madrid authorities since the beginning of this process, which is to refuse to negotiate about a legal change in the status of Catalonia, which may have stopped short of full independence. It may have just been an increase of fiscal autonomy, but something that wouldn't have led to outright separation. On the one hand, doing that, and on the other, using legal means to try and deter any Catalan politicians from acting. I mean, down to prosecuting them in court. That's been carrying on, you know, for at least 3 years now. And as I say, it's created the thing that it purports to be against. It brings back memories of the worst attitudes during the dictatorship. And it's so unnecessary, because before this process began, I don't believe that there would have been a majority for complete separation in Catalonia. There may have been a majority for some more devolution, but there was no evidence that there was a settled majority for a clean break. And simply holding that referendum legally, you know, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, would have produced maybe not a huge one, but I suspect a majority for continued union and put the issue to bed, instead of which Madrid has now created this crisis.
If Mariano Rajoy carries on this path, carries on this attitude towards the Catalans, what will happen next? What do you think will be the next phase?
Well, we've already heard the president of the Catalan Generalitat saying that he intends to declare independence. That declaration will be a UDI. It won't have any constitutional force in the eyes of the Spanish government. The Spanish government has already made pretty clear that it will respond by revoking the autonomy, the devolution that Catalonia already enjoys under the Constitution. The talk in Madrid is of going further and cutting off the money that Catalonia gets, as it were, through the national taxation system. There is an element of local taxation in Catalonia, as in other Spanish regions, but they don't yet have the full infrastructure of what a sovereign state would have, when it comes to fiscal independence. And so if Madrid cut off the money, I think there would be an immediate economic crisis. We can already see the beginning of a collapse in the Spanish stock exchange. If this were to get worse, then we'd be looking at a reversal of all the recent recovery in Spain, and I think we'd be back to a full-scale euro crisis. And very quickly in Brussels, Brexit would be the least of their worries.
But looking at the Scottish example, the question hasn't been solved by the referendum there, has it?
I'm not sure that that's true. I think the question has broadly been settled. There was a 55-45 vote, and both sides recognised that when a nation is that closely divided, the only way to build a consensus is with something in between the two. And that's broadly what's now happening. Scotland will enjoy greater devolution, including a measure of fiscal autonomy far greater than previously enjoyed, but stopping short of complete independence. Now, obviously, that's going to go too far for some people, and of course, it won't go far enough for some people. But I
you don't think unionists like you and me are reading too much into the latest election result that suggested that the SNP are on the way out?
Well, I mean, but that's a result of the increased devolution. I mean, not only support for the SNP falling, but support for independence is falling. Remember that during the Brexit referendum, we were repeatedly told that if the UK as a whole voted to leave, but Scotland voted to stay, that Scottish independence was inevitable. It was one of the classic Project Fear tropes. In fact, support for separatism is collapsing. Nicola Sturgeon has shelved her plan for a second referendum. And the issue, I think, has been settled. And the reason it's been settled isn't because of the Brexit referendum. It's because the government responded sensibly to a 45-55 vote by trying to find a compromise. And I've lost count, Freddie, of how many times I've had this conversation with Spanish Conservative friends, where I've given them the example and I've said, this is how we defuse the issue and it seems to be working. And the answer is always, Scotland is not Catalonia. Well, as a statement of fact, that is, of course, unarguable, but it's also irrelevant here because the basic fact that if you treat people like a subject population rather than as your fellow citizens, they'll want to leave. I mean, you know, it's the most basic human instinct. If you are free to leave at any time, and there was never any question that Scotland couldn't hold a referendum if that was what people wanted, if you're free to leave at any time, then you feel relaxed about exercising that right. The moment you think that the right is going to be taken away from you, the moment you feel that you're being locked in, what are you going to do? Of course you're going to bolt for the door.
That was Daniel Hannan.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, what makes a perfect pub quiz? That might be the hardest question of all to answer. But luckily I'm joined by Mark Mason, who has a new book about it called Question Time, and it's all about quizzing, and Andrew Hunter-Murray, who presents No Such Thing as a Fish, the QI podcast. Mark, you say in your piece that the quiz is perhaps more popular than ever now because for once people have to switch off their phones and use their brains, use their memories. Why are we so desperate to have known unknowns?
I think your Donald Rumsfeld quote. Yeah. Now, yes, I think it's because it's sporting. You know, it would just be completely uncool to cheat at a pub quiz. To be seen taking your smartphone out would be naff. And we like knowing.
I've cheated.
Yeah, well, normal people, Freddie, with morals, wouldn't do that. And there seems to be it's a very social thing. A quiz that comes through in the team names, and people have fun thinking up their team names and doing. I've written a book about quizzes, going around Britain looking at different quizzes, and going around. I noticed people love their team names. Quiz Team Aguilera is quite a popular one at the moment, and Quizzy Wig and all that sort of stuff. And there was a corporate quiz where a team from Deutsche Bank had called themselves Deutsche Wish Your Girlfriend Was Hot Like Me. So there's a lot of thought and love that goes into forming a quiz team. And then you just want to have fun. And I think it's the joy of not knowing, the joy of going back to what it was like when I was a kid, when you were a kid, and you're a bit younger than us, but I think you can just about remember the time before the answer to every question in the world was in your pocket. Younger than the internet. You had to wait to look up an answer. And there's a little joy in deferred gratification of you get a question like, you know, the Queen and Prince Philip, one of them prefers a shower in the morning, one of them prefers a bath, which way round is it? It's fun guessing. It would be silly to look it up. It's fun guessing and waiting 20 minutes for the guy at the quiz. Go on, Andy. Andy's now looking, he's going to guess it. Which way round would you go?
Queen, bath, Phil, shower.
This is it. And the beauty is, I've used this at lots of quizzes myself. People tend to get it right, and Andy's just got it right. Because then
he's a pro.
He's a QI elf. He knows his stuff.
And are you're a beneficiary of this sort of quiz mania that seems to be happening with QI and your podcast. Do you think it's all down to technology and people really wanting to use their brains again?
Oh, man. I mean, I hope so. I think there's the idea behind QI is that there is the fourth human drive, apart from the first three, which are food, sex and shelter, that the fourth one is curiosity, you know, wondering, oh, well, I wonder what's over the other side of that hill. So maybe the pub quiz plays into that ancient human desire to find out. It's just a much more esoteric version now. I mean, I'm rotten at pub quizzes. I'm really, really bad at it. And I've been at QI for 8 or 9 years now. And I find this very dispiriting. But they never ask about, you know, the historical ingredients of pesto, which is what I was looking up this morning for the P series of QI. Yes. Never comes up. So,
Well, Fraser, our editor, always says, you know, the ability to know has been replaced by the ability to find out. And that makes us feel a lot better about knowing nothing. But is that...
Yeah. So I think we like going back to the days when there wasn't the ability to find out. It's a sort of slightly retro thing. And you get all sorts of quizzes where they try and get clever and they give you plates of cheese, 8 different types of cheese, and you have to name them and taste and all that. No, people like an old-fashioned pub quiz with... And I went to a couple for the book which use technology and are now quizzing apps where you get to the pub and everyone downloads the app that lets you take part. And it just doesn't work. There's something about...
Is it because of cheating? Or just, should I stop going on about cheating?
I think you're revealing an awful lot about your own approach to life. It just doesn't work. One of them, you could only type in the first letter of the answer. And one of them was, which mountain? So you could put K for K2. And still get it right, even though the answer was Kilimanjaro. You know, it's the technology just doesn't work. And you like the tension at the end of a guy reading out the answers to the questions. A good showman can put on a show where reading out the answers, delaying the answer, like, and the ones that you feel as though you should know, like a question from the book is, its official title was Bloodswept Lands and Seas of Red. What was it more popularly known as? And Andy's doing that open mouth look of, oh, God, yeah. I should be able to get it. And if I give you the answer, and this is what
I'm
going
to get my phone up.
Now, let's see if Andy can remember it before Freddie can look it up.
I've got to get my phone.
He's got to get his phone.
Absolutely can't. Bless it when it's... it's a book.
No.
Okay, that's good. That narrows it down. So that
What
means...
was it more popularly known
the
as?
The National Anthem. No, I don't know. That's probably not a very good title for a National Anthem.
Here we go. Freddie has his phone.
But this is one where, on this. A, this is... my memory is so bad, I've completely forgotten what it was. But B, actually, is it a Googleable one?
Yeah, if you Google that, it'll come up straight away. In the meantime, I'm going to leave Andy to give Andy his chance to show off as an actor, because Andy, I know, is going to know the answer to this. A lot of bad quiz questions are, what's the capital of so-and-so? What's the capital of Albania is just a deeply dull question. What's the capital of Australia is a good question, because there's a story behind it. Oh, now Andy's looking panicked.
Looking panicked. See, this is why we never do well in the pub quizzes. I thought it was Canberra.
It is.
Oh, good.
But do you know why?
No.
Because your first two options, you instantly think of Sydney and Melbourne. And Canberra is only the capital because Sydney and Melbourne couldn't agree between themselves which should be the capital. So they specifically built Canberra just to be the capital because they couldn't decide between themselves. It's halfway between the two. So there's a little bit of a story. So when you go to a good quiz like that, you're learning something. Freddie's thumbs. We're now analysing Fred's thumb technique.
I have neither the ability to know nor the ability to find out.
What is it? So,
Blood, Sweat, Lands and Seas of Red was the official title of the poppies at the Tower of London.
Oh, of course it was.
And Freddie and Andy both did the sound. Thank you.
I wonder, I always think, as you were saying, Freddie, the thing about knowing stuff, is it a bit like being a cabbie, having the knowledge, and now you've been outgunned by the sat-nav?
Yes. And so quizzes actually become the only arena in which... Yeah, it's useful.
And as you say, a lot of them are ungoogleable. You know, you can work out ones that... And also, when you come to write the question down, like Ingvar Kamprad was brought up on a farm called Elmtarid near the Swedish village of Agunnarid. What did he start in 1943? I know for a fact Andy knows the answer to this.
Yeah, I'm out for this.
And when people write it down, they'll write down Ingvar, Kamprad, Elmtarid and Agunnarid. And then they'll usually notice if you take the initials
IKEA.
Of those IKEA. There you go, you got it. You
see. Right.
So it can make you feel clever. It can make you. neuroscientists distinguish between crystallized intelligence and fluid intelligence. They tell you that crystallized intelligence is what you know, the facts you've got in your head. Fluid intelligence is the ability to reason and to work on things and try and guess whether the Queen would have a shower or a bath and all that sort of stuff.
We have a fact about IKEA. We just found this. We found this out at QI because we've been looking into the news from the year, because we have also written a book. It's called The Book of the Year. One of the entries is about IKEA. I think it's that the world has just learned, after 7 years of Game of Thrones, that all of Jon Snow's luxurious furry capes that he wears in Game of Thrones are from IKEA.
Brilliant.
And I've just been catching up on the latest series. I cannot now see it without thinking all of you are wearing IKEA rugs.
That was Mark Mason and Andrew Hunter Murray. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast, hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Radoni, who are joined this week by A.N. Wilson. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on here, as well as great pieces by Jessica Behrens, Prue Leith and Andrew Marr, and many, many more. We have a special offer for podcast listeners. It is 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskin notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.